This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/ifanboy. This is iFanboy Media Splode, episode 19, The Many Saints of Newark, and Ted Lasso, season 2. Welcome to iFanboy Media Splode, episode 19. My name is Connor Kilpatrick. I'm here with Josh Flanagan.
Hello there.
And Ron Richards.
Hey, friends. How are you?
We're the original hosts of iFanboy. We're here to talk about all things non-comics media on our monthly Media Splode show, unlocked by the patrons at patreon.com/iFanboy. They're the ones who bring you all kinds of great content. They bring it to you because everyone can enjoy it. And this was one we always liked doing, talking about things not related to comics that we've been enjoying in the month since we last spoke. And we have a lot to do.
Pack show.
Packed rundown. So we're going to start with our normal segment, what we've been enjoying, but we're going to be quick about it. I got the bell here, just in case.
I love it. Shit. Oh, it's been so long since I've been involved with the bell. Please use it.
So.
You long-time iFanboy listeners, you know. If you know, you know.
I will start off talking about a show that I saw a trailer for during another show I watch. And I thought, well, that's interesting, and am I going to watch it? And I decided just to record the first episode and see what I thought, and I enjoyed it, and I'm about three quarters of the way through the first season. It's called American Rust. It's on Stars.
Oh, is that the one with Jeff Daniels?
So it stars Jeff Daniels and Maura Tierney.
I was curious about that.
I describe it as male mare. Male mare means it's a show that takes place in a small western Pennsylvania town. Beaten down by industrialization. There's a drug problem.
Wow, even same area.
It's crazy. It's the same area. There's not the same fidelity of accents in this one.
Oh, I was like, does Jeff Daniels do the accent?
No, Jeff Daniels does Jeff Daniels, which is basically why I watched it in the first place. It's obviously not as good as Mare of Easttown, but I really have been enjoying it. It's more of a straightforward cop show, although there is a lot of plot lines. There's a whole subplot about unionization. There's a subplot about drugs in the area. I'm sure all of it's going to be related. There's a subplot about a romance between two characters who shouldn't be having a romance. So there's all kinds of things going on, but mostly it's about this murder that takes place in the first episode. The real big difference here between this and Mara, beyond many other differences, is that the sheriff, because it's such a small town, is much more intimately involved in the murder and perhaps caught up in it. I don't want to spoil too much about it, but if you enjoy bleak small-town murder cop shows, American Rust is for you. You know, I feel like we're going to get a lot of these now. You know, we're a decade into the opioid crisis. People have processed it. Now we're starting to get shows that are dealing with it. Sometimes literally like Dope Sick that's coming out soon.
I feel like we're more than that. I mean, like, if you, like, the first season of Justified, the whole thing, like, there was a lot of that. That was like 15 years ago.
Yeah, I think we're talking specifically about like the opioids, which
as a topic, right?
Yeah. Justified is more like heroin, and which is where it started too. But like this is more like people crushing up pills from the pharmacy. And
I know we need to keep this short, but are you going to watch Dope Sick? I asked you in Slack, but you didn't respond.
I'm not sure. I love Keaton.
Keaton.
I wasn't gonna, and then I saw the trailer. Like, I wasn't not gonna, but I wasn't like, I'll gotta get to this as soon as possible. Right. But then I saw the trailer, and I saw, like, the rest of the cast.
It's a great cast.
None of whom I remember right now. Yeah. But I was like, wow. And Lindsay's like, we gotta watch that.
All right, so I'll check it out.
I saw him on Colbert. He said it is kind of depressing.
Oh, well, that's not great.
I don't see how it couldn't be.
Just now when you said plot lines,
yeah.
Do either of you know what popped in my head?
No.
Plot lines, yes. Ask a Ninja.
Thank you. Okay, carry on.
Oh. Just my last point on this, Josh, will be there's a lot of actors, solid from the shows we like to watch, like Bill Camp from the nice. Night Of is in it.
You don't have to tell me who Bill Camp is.
No, I'm just for the people. Jim Trufrost from The Wire has a small role in it.
Mr. Presbo.
There's a lot of those kind of actors. Like, oh, that guy. Dallas Roberts. Mm-hmm. It's a good cast. It's interesting. There's this bizarre side plot about one of the characters running away from home and becoming a modern-day hobo. I literally just watched the most recent episode right before the show.
When does the bell ring? Is it like a 10-minute thing?
Yeah, it's like, I like how he's not monitoring his own bell. Like, that's great. Yeah.
It's the power of the bell, really. Power goes ahead. Ron, what have you been doing?
All right, well, ding. Real quickly, it will be no surprise, but the... thank you. Oh, all right. Oh, well, Josh, you're up. ESPN 30 for 30. Once Upon a Time in Queens, the four-part documentary about the 1986 Mets. Tune in for the brashness and wildness of the 1986 Mets. Stay to watch Keith Hernandez playing with his cat.
I've watched two of the four, and
I didn't even know it was a thing. I'm on it.
Yeah.
Oh, Josh, you need to watch it. I mean, like, Ron and I lived through it. I was
Connor, nine. They showed games I was at.
Yeah, I mean, we run and live through it, and I've read the book, The Bad Guys Won.
I was watching with my wife, and they showed the 4th of July fireworks, and I'm like, I was there. I was sitting right there.
But nothing really prepares you to really have it laid out, and then, you know, they interview basically everyone who's still around, and they just don't give a fuck.
Nope.
Lenny Dykstra does not care what you think about Lenny Dykstra.
Well, it's also, and that's the other thing, too, is that I love that team. I idolized, I mean, truly my first, like, I was nine when it happened. It was my first kind of, like, idolization of, like, putting on a pedestal. There's, I can watch someone doing a feat and, like, look up to them. And I looked up to Gary Carter. I looked up to Keith Hernandez. I loved Mookie Wilson. Dykstra was great. Like, up and down, I could give you the entire lineup and tell you something about every player on that team. And seeing everybody now is both also interesting and sad because, like, you know, like, it was great to see Sid Fernandez, and he looked great. He was one of my favorite pitchers. I got a baseball card signed from him at the TikTok Drugs in East Northport once. But Lenny Dykstra is just, it's a degenerate, and it's just sad. It's like, I know people are like, we're cracking up and think it's so funny, but it's like, dude can't even string a sentence together. Like, it's really, like, shows you what drugs and alcohol and crime and all this stuff can do. But either way, it was interesting because, you know, having lived through it and read so much of it, it was great to see a lot of the stories that I knew and have heard, but also to find out stuff I didn't know, which I thought was really interesting, and get to relive one of the most amazing double plays ever in the game against the Cincinnati Reds in July that caused my wife to pause the show to say, what just happened there? Play that again, which is like a dream. So, home run. Good job, ESPN.
It's fun.
Yep.
I was going to talk about Wu-Tang and American Saga Season 2, but I think I'm going to wait till it's over and just say I took a flyer on an audiobook and I started listening to Dennis Lehane's The Given Day based on a very short synopsis that I thought, oh, that sounds pretty good. And it's this, like, incredibly wide-ranging book. And I've known about Dennis Lehane forever. I've never read a Dennis Lehane
book. Oh, you never read? Interesting.
No, but, like, I'm aware of, I know what he does. I know the movie's based on his stuff, and I know he's a staff writer on The Wire, and I know, like, which are the ones that he, like, it's one of those things where, like, I know I'd like it, but I've never actually done it.
Oh, yeah, Boston-based, hard-boiled crime stuff.
It takes place in 1919, and it's just this convergence of all of these things, the Spanish flu, Babe Ruth going from Boston to New York, Tulsa riots are involved with it, the police strikes, unionization, the anarchist and communist scare, the anti-Italian stuff that went along with that, the anti-Irish. It's this incredibly wide-ranging, massive amount of stuff. And with that kind of dialogue that he's known for, you know, which I've now been like, oh yeah, I totally see why. There were all of these bits where I thought, this is just... But I immediately sent it to Connor. I didn't even finish the book. I was like, I you haven't read this, right?
You were talking about it. And suddenly it appeared in my door. And I was like, oh, okay.
that's a thing that has to... I was just like, I don't care when you get to it. I started reading the second one after that because it's a trilogy of people who... It doesn't go one right after another. It changes characters.
He's a really interesting writer. I like his books a lot. I've only read maybe three.
What have you read?
I read Mystic River.
I love that movie. Like, I've watched it many times.
His first one... whose the name escapes me. It's really gritty. It's got the characters from Ben Affleck's first movie with Casey Affleck. What was the name of that one?
Oh, the
Mallrats?
No.
I mean, technically.
Ethan Suffley and...
I know what you mean. I can't think of it right off the top of my head. So what's really interesting is that I started reading the second book, Live by Night, which Ben Affleck made a movie.
Oh, that was a bad Argo, movie.
I think I watched that movie. That was a bad
movie. Which apparently is terrible. And I was reading about it, and I was like, well, wait, who did Ben Affleck play? Because the protagonist in this
Gone,
is
Baby, Gone.
Old.
Gone, Baby, Gone.
Oh, that's it, yeah.
Michelle Monaghan.
I read Gone, Baby, Gone, Mystic River, and his first one, which I name escapes me. Continue.
Protagonist is 20 years old, and I was like, well, who does Ben Affleck play?
It's Gone, Baby, Gone is different than Gone Girl, right?
Let me finish the sentence.
Those are two different movies, right?
Okay. Different books, yes.
And he played the 20-year-old instead of like the old person. I was like, oh, there's your mistake right there.
Well, it's a bad movie for many reasons.
Yeah, no, yeah. I can't. You know what's funny is that anyway, so far, I'm like halfway through. It's not nearly as good as the one before it because it's much more straightforward. But yeah. Boy, the Given Day just blew me away, and I couldn't get enough of it. It was for an audiobook, it was super long. As a prose book, I think it's, you know, 1,000 pages or so. It's big book.
It's thick. I don't know if it's 1,000 pages, but it's thick.
Can I ask a question? No. Yeah. Connor, is the bell working?
Yeah, I just checked it.
I riveted him.
You did.
Okay, so that's what we've been enjoying. Normally, we spend more time on that, but we have a lot of things to dig into. We're very excited to talk. The first thing we're going to talk about is the Many Saints of Newark, or the Multisantes of Newark.
My wife told me about that the next day. She's like, oh, and I go, what? Oh, that does make sense.
So this is the prequel film set in Sopranos world that was originally going to be released to theaters at Warner Brothers. It did go to some theaters, but it's also on HBO Max. That's where I watched it. We should start by saying we're all Sopranos fans. We've all watched it. I've only watched it once all the way through, and Josh has watched it multiple times.
Many times.
Ron?
Once all the way through, but like have watched a lot every now, you know, like when it was on, like that sort of thing. But never sat down and rewatched it type thing.
So David Chase, you know, ended the show however many years ago it was? More than 10?
Oh, it's like 14, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was 06, 07.
Yeah, it was 07, yeah.
People have been dogging him for years. Talk about the ending. Explain the ending. Is there going to be more Sopranos?
One of my favorite endings of TV of all time.
He should never explain the ending.
Never
explain
it.
He ended up explaining it.
I know, but it shouldn't have happened.
And then he announced, hey, I'm doing a movie, and it's going to be a Sopranos prequel. And what was your guys' initial reaction when you said that?
Ugh.
Don't do that.
Yeah.
But... you know, so that's my instinct on anything. You cannot go back to the well. I was been having conversations about this recently. Like, when have they gone back to the well and have it been okay? Like,
well, so what echoed with me as I watched it was a couple of weeks ago, Josh, you said we were talking and you said, I just need this to be good.
I need it.
I really want. So that's the point, though. I was like, no. And I saw the trailer and I was like, I really want that to be good.
Yeah.
So I let myself get excited about it.
Right. Well, the thing is, Star Wars
taught me not to do.
The pedigree is pretty good. David Chase co-wrote it with Lawrence Connor. It was directed by Alan Taylor. Chase was supposed to originally direct it, but he had a family crisis. Alan Taylor directed a lot of the big Sopranos episodes. He directed a lot of the big Game of Thrones episodes. He directed Thor: The Dark World, which almost made him quit directing. And is starring, you know, Alessandro Nivola and John Bernthal and Corey Stoll and Leslie Odom Jr., Ray Liotta, Vera Farmiga.
It's got a cast. It's definitely got a cast.
It's got a really, really good cast.
I got to say, I saw is it Corey Stoll? That's his last name?
Yeah.
Like, he gets, I don't know if it's typecast, but he's like, you know, the scummy jerk guy. And I was like, oh, don't put him in this. And I don't mean to get ahead of everything, but I was like, nope, I was completely wrong about
that. Well, no, here's the thing, and you are getting ahead, but I had the same thought, is that at first I was like, oh, Corey Stoll's playing Junior? And then there was, and when I first saw him, I was like, I kind of groaned. Then there was another point where I was like, holy shit, he's amazing.
Yep.
And then,
I was like, nope, that's him,
but
I can't.
But then the moment he said your sister's C the second time, I was out. I was like, oh, screw that.
Okay.
And if you ask me, that's the example of my problem with the entire film.
You are one step ahead. So
Josh started.
The movie takes place in the 1950s, 1960s.
70s.
It goes to the early 70s.
It's 60s, 70s. Yeah, no 50s. It was after Crazy Joe in Appalachia.
The dates don't match up with the TV show dates. Yeah. That's a whole other problem.
Ugh.
Tony's a young kid in the beginning. By the end of it, he's a teenager. This is the story of a lot of the characters from the show when they were younger, plus a lot of their parents or uncles or people that we only heard about or saw fleetingly or were played by much older people in the show. So it's sort of a very turbulent time for the mob in Newark at the time of the movie. What did you guys think?
All right. I have three distinct thoughts, okay?
Go ahead.
One is, we've talked about it on the show a lot, and I'm just going to say it, and then we're going to move on because I'm sure we'll talk more about it, but fan service. That's one thing that held this back a lot.
Prequelitis.
The second one is that I thought that the lead's name?
Alessandra Nivola.
Alessandra Nivola was delightful and fantastic, and I thought he was the shining star of the entire thing, and the entire film... There was a story there that suffered from the format, and if you stretch this out into a series, I think they were TV people trying to make a movie, and stuff moved too fast. Final thought is the juxtaposition of the race riots of 1968 and the relationship between what's his name?
Dickie Maltisanti
and his African American friend was a compelling and interesting story that could have been told without being a Soprano story.
Yes.
Those are my three thoughts.
Josh, overall thoughts?
And so generally, I give it a thumbs down.
So I finished it, and I found it equally enjoyable in parts because there was a guessing game.
Yeah.
And I know the Sopranos very well. You know, I'm extremely familiar with the show. And, you know, you do the thing, well, wait, who's that supposed to be? Yep. Which is kind of fun, but at the same time, I was like, I hate that I'm doing this.
Right.
Because this is not the same thing as experiencing a story. It's a different thing. And so I'm not sure, I don't think it succeeded, because I'm not sure what it was trying to do. But I can't tell you I didn't enjoy either it, or at least, you know, significant parts of it. I did enjoy, like, well, how are you going to do this? How is this? Specifically the kinds of things where I was trying to see how they had somebody reinterpret that character or given character at an earlier age. So we were talking about Junior, and I was like, oh, he was always crabby. And I took it that the way it was supposed to. Like, oh, he's like a nerd. He doesn't fit in.
He's Fredo.
Yeah.
And right. And that's why later he's the way he is. And I liked that.
And the twist with him was powerful.
It was. And it was unexpected. Right. So I can give it that. The thing where Tony did a thing that he did when he was older where... It would come for him to, somebody would blame him for something, and he would immediately shift the blame to something else, how it wasn't his fault. And I was like, oh, that's what the adult one did to justify everything that he was doing. Some of the psychological stuff that I think that David Chase had put in the show later to have it sort of show up in a fairly elegant way with some of the characters. And this isn't having to do with the story, because I think that's where you have a problem with the movie. I'm not sure what the story was. Right. Other than a format for these other things to happen, but
well, they tried to cram in multiple stories into that format.
Let me give my overview. So I watch it on a Sunday morning. While I had a couple hours to myself, and as a thing to do on a Sunday morning by myself, like I had a fine time watching it. But it's not a good movie.
No,
I had almost the same reaction I had to the Deadwood movie, which I did enjoy. Is that it felt like the outline of a season or two of a TV show. And they showed me all the highlights. This is like a treatment in movie form. Mm-hmm. Here's all the things that are going to happen in this season. And in that sense, it felt too overstuffed. Like Ron said, there were too many plot lines between the mob stuff and the race riots and the gender issues that were going on. There was a lot of things happening that never got explored because they're too busy getting to the next thing and the next thing.
And what's interesting is that in the show... He did that too, and it was actually, he left a lot of stuff dangling, but at least he got to spend a little more time with it, and you had an idea of it. In this,
he had 90 minutes for all of this stuff.
The saving grace for me about The Sopranos was a great telling of a type of people, mob people, in New Jersey, in present day, and the biggest complaint people have about the finale, about the woods, about everything, is that you don't know what happened. And what I always said about The Sopranos 15 years ago was, that's like life. Somebody pisses you off, and you don't know why that happened, and you'd never find out, and that kind of thing. And I love that The Sopranos kind of embraced that. Whereas here, it didn't work because it gave you enough of a, to Josh, to your point, it didn't spend enough time with the stuff. And
it's prequelitis.
Prequelitis, exactly. And part of the problem was, is that, you know, like they established that Dickie Moltisanti and Leslie Odom Jr. were friends. And then they're not, like, it was such a
very quickly
and impacted the story in such a way that I didn't feel it, that I didn't carry with it.
Because it was an overview.
Right.
It wasn't
yeah.
really a story.
I think it tried to cram too much story in. But I also think that if they weren't too worried about, oh, there's Paulie doing his nails, and there's, you know, like they like a sign for me of something when you're trying to prequelitis or, you know, do the nod wink. Honestly, it's Kevin Smithisms, right? Is when like they were, when Tony was trying to get beer, was trying to get Dickie to buy him beer and was at the phone, and he's there with a friend of his and a girl, and he said Carmella in a way that was unnatural. He's like, oh, they want us to know that that's Carmella. Like, and that's the stuff that pisses me off. Like, that's the.
Did he call her Carm there?
No, he called her Carmella for the first time. And it was like, it was way. Because I noticed it. I was like, you shouldn't notice it.
It wasn't the friend, the restaurant guy.
Yeah, Artie Bucco. Yeah. We hear about that because he's talking about the restaurant. Like, it's like, this is what I hate. I hate the prequel tourism of here's everybody you love, but younger and different. And like, oh, it's so annoying.
Well, earlier there
doesn't help the story.
Was with somebody, and I was like, "Is that Tony Blundetto, or is that Artie, or is that there's Johnny?" No, wait, who? So who is the boss? Jackie
April. Yeah.
So who was he in this?
Yeah, he was in the Mr. Softee truck.
Oh, okay.
It was Jackie and Tony and.
I thought like at a certain point I was like, if you're gonna do this, like connect it, show things that you talked about in the show. There was one thing when Johnny Boy shoots Livia in the head.
Yeah.
And through the hair. Yeah. I think that was in the show.
It was in the show, yeah.
She was amazing, by the way.
Oh, I hated her. But I hated the mother.
No, right, yeah. No, she's one of the she is the most disturbing and evil character of all time.
Yeah.
Like when you watch her, it is so uncomfortable. Yeah. I do want to say
I hated the prosthetic. Ugh.
Ray Liotta shows up and I thought, you need to settle down,
yes.
Ray Liotta. I don't think you should even be here.
I thought it was great. Oh man.
However,
the swerve.
When he shows up again, because I went,
he's better.
He's in prison. How is he dead? That secondary role
was amazing.
Ray Liotta blew me away.
Like we had to pause the movie when he first came out, and then a couple of minutes later, we're like, holy shit! Like him as the incarcerated brother was amazing. Was great.
Yeah, really good.
Oh man,
he played it low key.
Yeah,
you see, he was holding a Joe Pesci record.
No.
Jeez.
One of the records with the Joe Pesci one. I do want to get to the last point I had, which was brought up by our friend of the show, Henry, or also
Henry,
enthusiast of The Sopranos.
Kid Henry.
It's two movies. It's Dickie Moltisanti's story and it's Tony's story, and they're two different films, two different stories, and we're never quite sure which one we're supposed to be the main story.
And I also don't think there was enough meat to Tony's story at all. Like,
right, that's the thing. Like, we never got enough time with either one. It was like we're following Dickie for so long, and I forgot Tony was sort of even a character. And then it switches gears, and then you're like, wait, what happened?
I was talking to a coworker today, and I said the biggest transgression against this film is that it's been marketed so heavily to be like, see Tony before he becomes Tony, when the movie's not about him at all. It is a plot line. It is a piece of it, but
it's not connected enough to
exactly.
It.
Well, the second half does change to become Tony's story. That's why it's so weird, because it was Dickie's. Then Dickie disappears for like 25 minutes.
And it's like, wait. Also, like the shit with like when Christopher is a baby crying when Tony holds him, and the woman's like, babies know things from the other side. It's like, come on. Like, it just, I don't know.
Well, yeah. I mean, that goes along with Christopher from the Dead narrating it.
Well, I didn't mind that. I didn't mind that much. But it's just like, I don't know. I just hate that. I just hate the shining.
It's
the
very David Chase, though. Yeah, it's very David Chase.
That is very David Chase. It's also very much his version of this, like, Italian-American, you know, like, things. That's something that somebody would say. Yes, that's exactly the word.
You know,
that's something that somebody would say.
I had a couple of thoughts watching this. How old is Big Pussy?
How old is Sylvie?
Yeah,
because those guys are all like they seem to be around Tony's age on the show, but then here they're all like 15 years older than him.
See, I don't know the Pussy was, because Pussy and him are supposed to be best friends, but I know that.
Yeah, but he was much older.
Paulie was in Korea, I think.
Yeah,
you know, like so he would have been 10, 15 years older. I didn't know that Syl was that much older, but I was doing the math and I was like, I guess it kind of checks out. And then they're saying that when Syl was a kid, he was, you know, he lost his hair. I didn't even know he was supposed to be bald in the whole show.
Oh, wait, you didn't know that was a wig?
No, I just didn't think about it.
You watched it three times.
Jeez.
I never thought about it.
The Silvio actor was the worst transgression. Was like,
well, that's what I'm, the casting veered into SNL territory at times with Silvio and with Paulie Walnuts.
Paulie, yeah.
I thought some people like young Janice, I thought looked eerily like her older counterpart, but
that was good character stuff in there. That stuff was good. Like when you're showing these characters as younger.
Dial Silvio down 2%.
Yeah. Oh, no, 10%. 10%.
Yeah.
They could have done something interesting there.
Yep.
And they didn't.
Yep.
They did caricature.
Yep.
And I know that those characters are kind of caricature, but it would have added to them if they had done something interesting.
Yep.
And they didn't.
It was weird.
It was
weird. Like I didn't have a bad time watching it, but at the end of it, I was like, that wasn't.
Oh, yeah, no, as we're watching it, we're like, oh, this is not good. Like, and you're waiting for him to go back to jail and talk to Ray Liotta.
He was great.
He was so good.
There was a lot of good Goodfellas
references. I don't think I watched it real. I think I may have had a Phantom Menace moment where I was like, I want very much to enjoy this.
You said you needed it to be good.
I did, and I wanted to. And again, I enjoyed watching it. I think if you can disassociate yourself, sort of, I think I didn't realize. I was trying to understand if it was good or not. I was trying to make it good in my mind, which let me enjoy the things that were happening. And at the end, I was like, I don't know what to think, which is not a good sign. You know, like you either know it's bad or you know it's good. And then a few days later, I was like, I'm not thinking about it anymore. That's not good.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was...
I can talk to you about the season three anytime you'd like. You know, I could tell, like, it's like single episodes, I will go on and on. One of my favorite things I ever heard about The Sopranos, by the way, was an interview where Jonah Hill was talking, I guess it was Marin or something like that, and he said, what the show is, it's a comedy, which I believe The Sopranos is a black comedy, I believe it is hilarious, about cavemen who cannot work in the modern world. And whenever I watch through that lens, it's great for me. It is anyway, but like that's how I tend to look at it, and this wasn't that at all, but that's not its fault.
Yeah, it's tough. What did you guys, so I assume that one of the big reveals is that Uncle Junior kills Dickie.
Right.
Has him killed. Was there anything else that was like revealed? I mean, not knowing it as well as
I mean, that's
guys,
a, that's, that was revealed? Even so, that being the thing, so what? Yeah. Although I think it did describe that Junior never liked Chris. Ever.
Yep.
That was the thing. And so I hope that David Chase knew that story. I hope that he wrote that backstory.
I'm sure
backstory.
He did.
Yeah.
I'm sure he wrote
good.
The backstory.
I hope so. But he's also the kind of guy like, he wouldn't tell
or you can
if
take
he
that and say, why? Well, he hated him. Let's right. use it. I did. Yeah. I mean, one of the first times when I realized that he was basically the Fredo character, when every time he said anything, the other ones made fun of him, I was like, oh, he's going to kill these guys. So when Dickie gets shot in the back, I couldn't tell if that was him or not. I was like, is that Junior? And then I realized, okay, it definitely Junior did it.
Because the call.
One too many indignities, making fun
And that goes back to the you never understand, because it's just a pointless, like it's not a power play. It's not a, you know, anything like that. It's because he pissed them off and he finally had it, you know? And they
have no self-control.
Yeah, exactly.
Pride.
You know, and so what's interesting and what I've read all the articles about, like, well, did Tony know, or was it just a way to manipulate Christopher and all this sort of stuff? And I fall back on the George Lucas, you know, kind of Occam's Razor, and that no way that Chase had that planned as far back as when Tony did the Christopher. Like, I have to, like, it's revisionist history, basically.
Right.
And, you know, I can't speculate what Tony knew. We don't know. We don't know what his motivations were, whether he was manipulating Christopher, if he ever knew. I would think that if he knew, he knew his junior, he wouldn't have let it stand, right? And so, yeah,
this would definitely indicate that when he gave, in the show, when he gave Chris the address of that cop.
Yeah.
That he either was wrong, or it wasn't that at all. It was some sort of test.
Or it was manipulation or whatever it is. The thing is that this changes that moment in the show. Right? This is a retcon, basically.
Ooh, I don't like that. Although, it does and it doesn't. Because we didn't know at the time, and neither did Chris, which is the crux of sort of him that episode. And so the other guy is confused. You know, he never says, fine, I did it. You know, like whatever. He doesn't remember. And you're stuck in this place where you've got pride and arrogance and violence making these people do awful things over and over again, which in that way it is connected.
Are we supposed to believe that Christopher was his son?
Right, because didn't he said my wife can't bear any children?
They went through a whole long scene about how they couldn't have kids. And then this is another problem, like, next scene, oh, we got a kid. It's like, wait, what?
That was
again,
weird.
It's like the highlights.
Yeah,
there's
confusing.
No connective tissue. I thought maybe like she had an affair, like they were going to set that up, but that didn't, you know, go anywhere. I just was like, there was all these moments where you're just like, where's the connective tissue to these moments here?
I thought we were going to say that the Chrissy was going to be his Gumar's.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought too.
But that wasn't it. And you're right. All of a sudden there was a baby and that kind of, and then he went away. The baby never showed up. We didn't talk about him again other than he was narrating the show. Yeah, then the thing with the Gumar was weird, didn't really matter, other than he slept with the...
I will say this, though. There's nothing better than a mobster eating angrily in his undershirt,
yep.
boxers, and shorts.
Sausage, some good sausage.
Good sausage.
Can we... Sausage. I will say that whatever it is that Odom Jr. does, I don't recognize him from one thing to the next.
He's having a really interesting post-Hamilton career.
End of the movie, I said, turn to my wife. I'm like, did you like Leslie Odom? She's like, he's in it? And I was like, yes, that was it.
Unrecognizable.
I kept looking for him. Yeah. I could see little hints of him as Hamilton, like the I'd see like his tooth and go, wait, there it is. But other than that, didn't look, didn't sound, didn't move. Like he must be an amazing actor. Because
he's very good. I didn't peg him as the one to come out. Like it was David Diggs came out originally with the most interesting career, and now he has it.
Yeah,
he's very good. Well, the last question before we move on to the next segment is Michael Gandolfini. What were your thoughts?
I mean. Am I a jerk if I say I didn't like him?
Bad for him?
Yeah, am I a jerk if I say I didn't like him and I feel bad for him?
I thought he was fine.
He was,
and he did the thing, and I bought it. But, you know, it's a weird stunt casting. But it's not much different than, like, Ice Cube's son playing him. And then you're like, wow, he does look just like him. He did a good enough job. I don't know. I don't think he was bad. I don't know that he got the best material. Obviously, that story was truncated. I don't think it was the best scene. He never had a chance.
Yeah.
You never had a chance. His dad is a dead martyred actor who did one of the most important role of this century. Yeah. You know, and he looks just like him, but I don't even know what to think. But I know that, like, it's not going to be able to do a thing about it. Like, it's too tall an order. And I feel bad because... I mean, like, I hope he goes on to do other roles and gets away from this and has his own success, but this can't be his breakthrough thing because that's not going to put him in a good position.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's hard not to think about things like
that. They really disrespected that ice cream. They really could have done a better job handing out the ice cream.
Yeah, they were, yeah.
See?
Yeah.
That was another scene, though, that, like, I was like, that's Tony. That makes sense because he would rob shit and then be like, we're giving away turkeys to everybody. Aren't I a good guy?
Yeah.
Yep.
And I think that's kind of cool. I really did like the... psychology of young Tony and how we see it develop later in the show. I thought that was thoughtfully done.
So what do we give a final rating grade to?
We're giving a
ratings.
Rating
out of ratings.
Five, Many Saints of Newark.
Ratings. Ratings.
It's tough.
As a movie?
Yeah.
Like a movie, standalone movie, it's like 2.25, 2.5. As an emotional sort of resonance with me, you know, I could maybe go so high as 3, 3.25. Does that make sense?
Sure.
There's one.
Yeah.
So you're averaging out at about a 3.
It's more like 2.75, okay, really. Fine. Like it's just better than middle.
I will go with a solid 2.5.
I'm going to go for the 2 out of 5. What about Ray Liotta's performance?
Oh, 4.5.
There's a curve, though.
Yeah.
Which one?
I mean, what's funny is that, like, the Buddhist atoning convict made me appreciate the insane, crazy other brother. Like, it was great.
I just wanted to know more about his murder. What did you do?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
But he was great. Every time he went to the prison, I was like, yes.
Yes, I know. Yeah, more, please. Oh, God.
And that was the Melfi Tony.
There's something about the serious Ray Liotta voice. Right, that he did in. I'm trying to think of a moment in Goodfellas, but it's a different. Like we all know the yelling and
he goes
and
down
like,
an octave.
He goes down an octave, right? You know, and it's like, and I'm trying to remember this scene in Goodfellas. I just read the freaking book.
He talks very low and slow.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. And so, like, it's. Yeah. I love that. Oh, it's great.
I thought that his voice. I thought he just sounded like the first one, all the time now. And so to watch him sort of.
Oh yeah.
You know what? Honestly, it made me think. Boy, they have not utilized this guy enough.
Yeah.
Like, he got typecast, and he put in his stuff. Like, he's a much better actor than I think he's gotten credit for, or at least clearly, maybe we haven't had a chance to see it, but I was, you know, at least they gave him this to do.
It's when he's talking to Maury, and telling Maury to be quiet when he opens the door and does the, huh? You know, like, when he's trying to protect him from Jimmy, it's that tone, down an octave, yeah.
So there you go, The Many Saints of Newark. It's on HBO Max if you want to watch it, or go see it in theaters.
Yeah.
It's out in theaters.
Buyer beware.
Let's turn to a television series that wrapped up this past week.
Controversial.
Last week. Season 2 of Ted Lasso. We talked about season 1 in a previous episode, whenever it ended last year. Who knows when that was, 1972, for all I know. This is...
What?
Well, it was so long ago, and I don't know when things happened anymore.
Time has no meaning.
So season two wrapped up on Apple TV. This is obviously the big Emmy-winning series. It won Best Comedy Series, it won Best Actor, Best Supporting Actor, Best Supporting Actress.
Didn't win everything, but it came close.
I was shocked by the amount of... I was like, wait, that person also won?
So season two ended, and I don't even know where to begin, where to approach this discussion. So I was trepidatious because, Ron, it felt similar to Glee in that season one was almost perfect.
Okay, yep.
And so it's like, well, there's nowhere to go from here but down.
Right.
There's just nowhere to go from down. Right. It was new. We're meeting the characters for the first time. You're never going to recapture that feeling. It ended perfectly. And so season two, I was already worried about, but I ultimately really enjoyed season two. They've discussed many times in interviews, this is the Empire Strikes Back season. Season one is a full-on story, and it's happily ever after. Season two kind of blows up, not in a big way, but blows things up a little bit. And season three, I assume, will be putting the pieces back together. But
you assume.
So a lot of things that make you uncomfortable in season two, a lot of things you don't like to see, a lot of things that made people on the internet angry.
Not being on the internet, by the way, gives me a completely contextless discussion. I just thought you guys were going to say what you thought.
No, I'm just saying it was controversial, yeah. Because people don't like to see things that make them upset because they don't understand storytelling.
People don't like anything. The Caesar's thing is that what happens is that people don't like when something isn't what they thought it was. And you had this thing, and it's like, oh, this made me feel good. And then they go forward, and they say, this isn't making me feel good. But that doesn't mean it was changing what it was doing.
No,
it means that your expectations were fucked up. So in light of all that, I think the thing that is consistent about this show is that it consistently makes choices to have people do the right thing or the thoughtful thing and then has its drama come from elsewhere other than that.
Right, right.
Because in a lot of shows, I'm struggling to think of examples, but so say that there's a scene here where Keeley and Roy start talking about their various minor infidelities.
Yep.
Not even, really.
No, I know that, but let me say, in other shows, that becomes the source of conflict, and then the characters are mad at each other for a while. In this, they went, no, they love each other, and it's a healthy relationship. And so that
is it, though? Is,
like, they talk...
you're running into his insecurities, never having really been in a real relationship.
You've seen the cracks, also, and yeah.
That's a good example of... people built them up into the perfect couple,
yep.
You know, and there's memes and there's all the, you know, but I thought all their problems this season were very natural and realistic. Yep. Like you get together with someone and you don't know how to be with someone. So you're first smothering them and then you have to back off. And then
I loved Roy reading the book while she's watching TV.
An ex shows up and says, I still love you. That causes some strife, or you meet someone else in another part of your life and you're like, oh, this person is actually interesting. But you don't do anything. But it causes issues to have to deal with or think about. And that's all very sort of realistic.
But they deal with it and they think about it and they talk about it as opposed to the thing, what I call the Wonder Years thing.
Right. But I'm saying, Josh, is people were using that as this is bad
because
these things are happening.
Whenever the choice was to do the thing that most TV dramas or comedies would use to make drama out of it, they didn't do that. They didn't make that choice.
Right.
The conflict was never the thing that is the stereotypical choice that TV shows make. And over again, that's the case.
Yep.
And that goes right down to, and I'm just, this is, we didn't give a spoiler warning, but I don't
spoiler warning around stop.
It. We already spoiled the first movie. So.
Yeah. Well, did we spoil it? I think it's spoiled already for us.
In that same way, the choice of taking Nate and making him the villain.
Yep.
Is difficult, but also I was like, that's how it happens.
It also made sense.
My statement on season two is that I thought season one was perfect. I thought it was delightful. It was what we needed. It was everything great. I thought season two was very good, was not great, slightly flawed in that the two bonus episodes are much maligned, the Christmas episode and the Coach Beard on the town after hours homage. I actually liked that episode, but we can talk about it later. I didn't care for the Christmas episode, but regardless, I felt as if this season felt longer, which I think because it actually was, but it also felt longer in that it deviated from the reason that we were there watching. And so there were times during the run of the season, with the exception of episode 5, which I think is the rom-com Roy Kent joins the coaching staff episode, which I think might be the best episode of TV I watched all year. It felt like, I was like, can we just get back to the soccer? Like, what's going on with the team? Like, they had built up all this stuff for me to care about, and they were exploring Ted's panic attack. They're exploring Roy and Keeley. They're exploring all this sort of stuff away from the thing that brought me to the show. But I will say they brought it back at the end. I thought they stuck the landing, and the Nate stuff is positively genius. The subtle, slow graying of his hair, like down to the blow up and the reaction, which is goes back to the Sopranos, is like, Nate didn't know that Ted had the picture on his dresser, right? And like,
right. That's what makes it tragic.
Exactly, yeah. And it's just like, and so like, I thought that after the 12 episodes, completely stuck the landing, but it did feel like it meandered through the journey, whereas the first season just felt tight and felt solid, you know?
You know, what you're talking about, though, is those are all, again, those choices things. That's why it feels like it meanders, because it isn't doing the thing that you expect. But when you look at it, you go, that was the right choice. That was the thing.
Mostly.
So, you know, yeah. When there was a couple of times, like when you didn't know who, what's her name?
Rebecca
was chatting to.
Yeah.
And at one point they alluded to it being Ted. And on any other show,
it's Ted for sure.
And the fact that it wasn't, and then it was Sam, and then that actually turned into a real thing.
Yeah.
They didn't. Will they? Won't they? I mean, they did later, but there wasn't like, we can't do this, and then it became awkward. Like, they let that be, and it turns out that they were actually into each other, and it was good. You know, those little things kept happening over and over again. If you think about, like, Jamie Tart, who was the villain of season one, you know, like, he sorted himself out.
Right. Yeah. He was great this season. Okay. I thought he was great this season. I still love, I love when the first episode of him back with him on the talk show, when he's talking about why he quit soccer to go on the reality show. He says, because when he found out that George Harrison died, it made him reflect on things. And they're like, but he died 20 years ago. And he's like, yeah, but I just found out.
I guess ultimately at the end of the day, I'm sorry, and you could totally talk. There was actual character development in the sitcom.
Yeah.
And that is really difficult for people to deal with, because we're not used to it, especially if it's something you don't like.
Yeah.
There's only one real villain on this entire show, and it's Rebecca's ex-husband.
Rupert. Yeah, who's brilliant. Barely in it this season and brilliant every time he's on.
Jamie was the nominal villain, but really he was just someone in a lot of pain, and they needed to figure out how to help him. And even Nate right now, that everyone is threatening his life on the internet, he is someone in a lot of pain.
Yeah.
The thing is, when he first started turning the season, people were like, whoa, where did this come from? Go back to season
one. It was there the whole time, yep.
His breakout moment was when he burned every player in that little locker room, and it was mean.
Yeah.
Like, he let out some aggression, and, you know, the quiet, nerdy guy who gets power and turns power hungry is certainly something we know about in society right now. But really, it's a father and son issue, whereas everything in here is a father and son issue. Ted's issues come from his father. Rebecca's issues come from her father. Jamie's issues come from his father. And really, Nate can't wrap his head around people caring about him, because his father doesn't. And so this is what the whole theme of the show is ultimately, is the relationship between fathers and sons. You know, Sam and his dad. It's all
fathers and sons, and honestly, like, the I know a lot of people were a lot of the chatter was negative on the therapist and coming into it but like the journey Ted went on with that therapist, and like it was great and gave us the context to his character, and understood that, like, oh yeah, this whole shtick is a defense mechanism, and it's like and it was great to see that get kind of deconstructed. And honestly, you know, and the speech to the team after he gets outed for the panic attack, and he gives the speech to the team, having that happen in that moment and see, you know, even despite being flawed and despite having internal problems, that he's dealing with them and coming out on the right side of things, and have that be in the context of the betrayal that's happening with Nate, I thought it was just great. It's just really well written. And I just also, let's just give it up for Trent Crim, who I hope comes back in season three, because he's the best.
I read the exit interview with Bill Lawrence, and both Trent and Dr. Sharon are going to be back next season.
Nice.
The Dr. Sharon stuff really got interesting in a way that
she was a great character by the end. Yeah. Hard drinking, and she has her own issues that they alluded to with her tons of empty wine bottles in her.
Yeah, that was good.
In a way that, like, that Melfi and Tony, like, I thought this was more interesting. Yeah. I never liked those scenes. Those are
the downside of the show, which is almost their own fault, is that there's too many great characters.
Yeah.
Well,
and so you can't spend time with them. Like, Trent Crim is a bigger piece of season one than two, but, you know, when he shows up, he's great.
Yeah, but I don't want to spend more time with him. I feel like, I'm very much like, I like what we get, and I don't want too much of a good thing.
Right, but my point is, like, they have so many characters. Rebecca's childhood friend who shows up at the funeral and is terrific.
Sassy.
And, you know, like,
sassy.
Sassy, and her daughter was terrific.
Yeah.
they move the spotlight around a lot, though. Yeah. So last season, the spotlight was on a couple of people. This season, you spent a lot more time with Sam, and you spent
He's so good.
You know, other stuff. And I think, like, you know, Jamie Tart was a big character in the first season, not the second. So this next season, we'll see more other people, and the other people will just have to, the people that are, you know, they'll just be more background, which is a difficult thing to do.
And Coach Beard, I liked because his episode a lot.
Involved.
Yeah, I liked the Coach Beard episode,
I liked
too.
It. Yeah. I enjoyed it. I think that I did have the thing of like, but I get to the story that we're doing. And I know that wasn't, by the way, my favorite, he had probably the best lines of everybody over and over. I think it was in the last episode where he's like, how's it going? I broke up with Jane. Oh, no, we're back. It's like that was one of those, like, again, they thought you were going to do, oh, there's where you're going to get the drama from.
Yep.
Nope. I mean, I let the air out of it immediately.
And very quietly, like, I love Higgins so much.
Yeah. Higgins is great.
When he slid into the window in the last episode to join the Diamond Dogs, he kills all these little moments and lines. And I loved him in the Christmas episode, him and his family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that he knew where all the players were from.
Yep.
He's the Ted of this season.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, he's the pure goodness and everything, which isn't to say Ted isn't, but they noticed they changed that. Like, they didn't have him have some deep underlying secret. Like, he's just happy to be there.
He's a good guy. He loves his wife. He has great kids. Yep. Yeah. He opens his house up. He knows every player. Like,
likes to play bass.
I had the sense that, like, at certain points, I found Ted-isms annoying. And I was like, maybe, are they doing this on purpose? Because he kept derailing whatever was going on with this thing, and it just stood out to me more in a way that at first you're like, oh, that's great. And then after a little while, like, can you just be a person? And I like that they, you know, like, this is his defense mechanism in a way. It is him, but it's also...
Well, he was in manic mode this season, right? Like, he was having a lot more problems. He was having a lot more issues, and he was being a lot
Which
more manic.
Which he should.
Yeah.
You know, like I left my family to go do this thing. You know,
it's not going well.
He loves his kid.
Yeah.
And at the end of that, like, that's a weird choice to make for a person who's like, he's kind of getting away from his kid for some reason. So what's that? Like, it's all these things that you can think about.
And now, look, I love the season, but it's not like season one's super tight. You know, this season wasn't as tight as it was. But
I think it's almost more food for thought, though.
Like, there's a lot more going on. There's a lot more to think about.
This conversation is more interesting than the conversation we had about the first one, which was, wasn't that great?
Yeah. There's a lot more issues.
Get something.
It's the Empire Strikes Back season. Everything sort of breaks apart a little bit. And we got to put it back together. And they might be casualties along the way of putting it back together at the end. But I thought everyone's story was interesting. Mm-hmm. Even little glimpses. I liked Isaac a lot. He's, you know, the captain. We got a little bit of him in that one.
I like that.
I would like the thing with his haircut.
Yeah, that was funny. But I mean, for me, when I look back at this whole season, I know it got very popular with the video game thing and stuff like that. But I thought the evolution of Roy Kent, right? Mm-hmm. I didn't know what they were going to do at the end of season one when he retired. I was like, oh shit, is he off the show or what's going to happen? Seeing the malaise of not having anything to do post, you know, that, and then trying to be a you know, a color commentator and, you know, and of course the Keeley relationship, but with that episode of him joining the coaching staff, I just thought was brilliant. And then just seeing somebody in the place they're supposed to be. And then just all the little mini adventures of the relationship and everything that was going on. Like there was not a episode that he didn't delight in some way for me. And so like, and I know everybody else loves him, so it's not, you know, it's not like it's a deep cut here, but I thought he was great. And going back to the Coach Beard episode, I love that it gave a little spotlight to the three fans in the pub.
Yeah.
You know, the Christmas episode I thought was fine. I thought it was very rote and it was kind of
delightful.
It was delightful, but didn't, you know, didn't impact the story, whatever. It was just a nice bottle episode. But Coach Beard's episode not only fit in with the story, but, you know, and maybe being a Scorsese fan and After Hours and all that sort of stuff, but also just like it was nice to have, especially after that big moment, a moment to breathe in something that wasn't everybody. Like, I thought that was the right move.
Yeah, and if you don't know, we're going to do 10. Apple asked for 12, so they'd already written the 10. So they wrote the Christmas and the Coach Beard episode, and they slotted them in to the season. So they came. They came out.
No complaints. No complaints.
We got in a long time till season.
No, a year. It's the same time as last time.
When was the first season over?
Connor, don't deal with time.
Yeah, don't deal with time.
I can't figure it out.
But it's going to be August 22.
And so interestingly, so they plotted three seasons originally. They wanted to do three seasons originally. It became a monster hit for Apple. Who knows if that's true or not. It won a bunch of Emmys. There's no way Apple's going to let them go after season three.
I think they will. I read that interview with Sudeikis at EW. Like, I think it's three and done. I hope they stick to it.
Well, he did say there's always the Apple money truck.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
We'll see. I mean, they spent $600 million on Foundation to show that no one who's not a super sci-fi nerd is going to enjoy.
I am a pretty, and I made it about halfway through the one, and fucking Joe McMillan's in it. I'm like,
can I just fucking rant for a second, by the way, speaking of Foundation and Joe McMillan and what is his name? Why is it blanking? Lee Pace?
Lee Pace.
Jared Harris? Oh.
The latest issue of Entertainment Weekly does a page on Lee Pace, and it's like tied into Foundation, and it's like Lee Pace talking about his most memorable roles, and fucking Joe McMillan wasn't even on the page, and I'm this close to writing a letter to the editor.
You should do it.
Burn that fucking
down. I know.
Down.
Come the fuck on. Jesus.
That's like doing a story on Timothy Oliphant and not mentioning Justified or
right,
Deadwood.
Yeah.
It's just...
Well, we got to talk about Go.
Yeah.
So let's get a real quick rating on Ted Lasso season 2 out of 5. Ted Lasso season 2 out of 5. Ratings.
Ratings.
If season 1's a 5, season 2 is a 4.5.
I'll give it a 4.25.
4.5.
All right, 4.5. Fine, 4.5.
You sticking with it?
Everyone's 4.5. Sticking with it, of course.
Yes.
All right, so we have a little bit of time, and we have an email that's relevant to some things we talked about this episode, so we're going to read an email from John V. from Brooklyn, New York, one of our old listeners.
Well, I wonder what neighborhood.
I don't even know if he's still there. I just know he used to be in Brooklyn, New York, and he didn't say this one, so I'm just going to assume. It's approximately the 6th anniversary of the start of Goodfellas Minute.
Wow.
It's holding up to a re-listen, a very dense podcast on a very dense movie. Any reflections? So this was our podcast we did 6 years ago.
Reflections of the way life used to be. I love that we did it because I read the book Made Men, the story of Goodfellas, recently. And very happy to say, I'm like, I knew that.
Yeah, when I was reading, I was like, did we do this? And I'm sure if we went back, the only thing I thought was when I read it was like, there's a little more context.
A little more. Yeah, a little more behind the scenes context that we don't have. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, but... You know, I've gone through, I was almost going to do like a listen, but that's not going to happen. But I listened to like the first few weeks and then a couple of spots from other. And
I can't.
I really was like, this was good.
It was
like,
a good
I'm
show.
Really proud of the work.
Yeah. We booked good guests. We prepared. Like, we probably did more work on that show than we.
Oh, way more.
For iFanboy, we've done a lot of like what you would call grinding, right? Like we've done a lot of like do the show every week. But I wouldn't say that we actually meticulously researched before recording in any way, shape, or form.
We rely on 30 years of just institutional knowledge. But
yeah.
A lot of fun. It nearly killed us to do a daily show in the midst of doing a weekly show about a whole other subject.
But it was so worth it, though.
I just remember so many nights... staying late at work in my office, either recording or editing.
Yep.
Because we were only ever more than a couple of weeks ahead and as few as a couple of days ahead.
Yeah, there's a couple of times. Schedule. We really flirted with disaster a couple of times.
I also think there was two choices that we made that were good.
Yep.
One is we did guests every other week.
Yeah.
And so we didn't become dependent on the guests. We had people in there. It was interesting, but there are a lot of shows and it's all about like, who is it this week? And we decided we don't have to have that. We can have people who fit. And other than that, we don't need to fill chairs for no reason. I think that was a wonderful choice.
Yep. We wouldn't have been able to book guests for every week.
We could have, but it would have been it would have hurt us even more, I think.
I think the other great choice is that we finished it and we're like, all right, we're good.
Yep.
We didn't go do another one. We didn't like we were like nothing.
I'm still kind of disappointed we didn't do My Blue Heaven.
It wouldn't have been.
It's hard to do a comedy. It's hard.
No, I know. I'm just saying. It was just geez.
You just end up talking. Wasn't that joke funny?
Yeah.
The movie, the Goodfellas, like there's so many ways to go at it, and it's hard to find other movies that you could do that with.
Well, we always said it had the perfect combination of a great film, historical discussions, geographic discussions that
places
we all
we've
like
been.
Yep.
The Venn diagram that covers all of the things that we like to talk about is very small.
Yeah, it really is zeroed right in, and I'm proud of the fact that like if you go to moviesbyminutes.com, we are number 2.
We're the second one.
Honestly, that website doesn't exist if we don't do this.
Mm-hmm. Well, Star Wars Minute.
Well, no, I mean, no, because Star Wars Minute did it. And then we had the relationship and we talked to them. We got the approval. And then other people were like, oh, we can do this too. And then it went from there.
I think that we did a better show than many, many would have done when that second one came along if we had
not. I agree.
If I can say it that way. And I'm also glad that we were the ones who did this
movie.
Very much so.
We did for a minute flirt with doing Jaws, but then somebody else started doing it, so we decided not to.
Yeah. But if you guys want to do The Departed, I'm there.
John V has a second question. To commemorate this anniversary, what are your top three or five, whichever is easier, Scorsese pictures? And he gives some context. As determined by the most comprehensive poll, the Decennial Sight and Sound Top 250 Critic and Director Consensus Poll, Taxi Driver came in 31, Raging Bull came in 53, and Goodfellas all the way down at 171.
That's bullshit.
Of the top 250 pictures. Without critics and just the polling of directors, Taxi Driver comes in as number 5 of all time, Raging Bull 12, and Goodfellas 48. No other Scorsese pictures make the list of 250 films.
But we're just picking.
I mean, we should take.
Yeah, yeah. What are your top three Scorsese
pictures? We should take Goodfellas and Taxi Driver off the table. At least Goodfellas.
I think you should only take Goodfellas.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. Fine. That's fair. Fine. Okay. So pick three non-Goodfellas.
It's tough. I recognize Taxi Driver is a great film. I don't want to rewatch it all that much.
It's very easy, Connor. Kundun, Kundun, Kundun.
Kundun, The Age of Innocence.
I got to say, before we do this, and I've seen most of these, but yeah. I don't love all of his movies.
No.
I think that's a thing.
Yeah.
You know, about him that's important. Like, I've tried to watch Mean Streets many times.
I love Mean Streets.
And I don't, like, I get it, but I don't love it.
That's what I mean, Josh. Like, I recognize it's a great film, but I don't really, if you're going to ask me to sit down and watch Mean Streets, I'm not going to say.
Yeah.
We've answered this question before.
Taxi Driver, I've watched a lot of times, and I do think it's great, but I wouldn't put it in one of my favorites.
Yeah. We have definitely answered this question before.
Yeah, so I'm just going to go ahead.
Can I guess yours?
Yeah,
Gangs.
Yeah.
I
just said one of them a minute ago.
What did you say? Mean Streets?
No.
Yeah, definitely. Kundun, Mean Streets.
Kundun, Mean Streets. You're going to say some bullshit like the George Harrison documentary.
Okay. No, talking about.
All right, well, I guess Gangs, so go for there.
Gangs, The Departed, and it was coming down between Casino and Wolf of Wall Street, but I got to go with Casino.
I don't like Casino.
Goodfellas light.
You know what? I didn't used to like it, and I've watched it several times in the past few years, and I've really come around.
He's directing The Devil in the White City?
Yeah.
Because, yes, because of the scope of it. And also, I feel it should be noted, Gangs of New York did a lot of things wrong.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm so fascinated by it. I've watched it over and over and over again, and I keep looking. I don't know.
It's rewatchable, also for subject matter. That could be a movie we could do. It would take us 15 years.
Yes. Well, that would be appropriate.
Mine are The Departed, Hugo.
I like Hugo a lot.
And, like, I want to say The Aviator. But
better
I also,
than you would think.
I want to say also Gangs of New York. Gangs of New York, again, very flawed, but it's rewatchable like crazy.
Yep.
But The Aviator, it's also really good. Great Leo, and also ticks a lot of my buttons of historical interest.
Yeah. I mean,
I think Gangs in New York, Hugo, and The Departed.
This is never one that is like set in stone. It changes and it evolves. But definitely Kundun. Definitely Michael Jackson's Bad. And no,
Italian American.
Yeah, Italian American. No, I gotta say,
you're gonna go with King of Comedy, New York, New York, and After Hours.
I mean. Not New York, New York, but King of Comedy and After Hours are definitely on the list. Last time we did this, I know we had, Connor, you said we answered this. I know we talked about this because I'm a big fan of Cape Fear.
It's a good movie.
Cape Fear is a very good movie. You know, and now, since we last did this, The Irishman and Silence both came out, and I liked both of those, surprisingly.
The Irishman, like, it's super enjoyable, but it's like almost...
Too long.
It's almost postmodern Scorsese watching, which is a little like Wolf of Wall Street to me. I was like, oh, I'm getting the feeling, but I don't know that it's
all right. Great. So I probably will go Cape Fear, After Hours, Gangs of New York.
Cape Fear, After Hours, Gangs of New York. Wow.
I will inform the both of you that Mr. Scorsese has directed the TV special An Afternoon with SCTV that is not out yet, but is a Jimmy Kimmel interviewing the cast of SCTV, including Connor Rick Moranis.
Oh, nice.
And that's going to be a must watch whenever it comes out. And why Scorsese directed this, I have no idea. There's a photo on IMDb of him sitting with Dave Thomas and Martin Short and Joe Flaherty and Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara.
You know, I haven't seen a good number of these movies.
That's okay. He's done a lot.
We should do a full watch and watch them all.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is this, like, I don't, like, if I consider Martin Scorsese's, some of his movies to be among my favorite movies of all time, but I don't necessarily be like, I'm a huge Martin Scorsese.
Well, when we met in college, you wouldn't shut up about The Age of Innocence. It was like, oh, Josh, I know, I get it. They're so innocent. It was,
and you were, and you would. What happened is that you laid your finger across my lips, and you just whisp, you just mouthed the words, "Kun," which was odd because it wasn't out.
Now, I will say, go back to watch Age of Innocence because you've got Richard E. Grant, you got Daniel Day-Lewis.
I would watch it right now if it was on. Or yeah. I'd watch it.
I think I'm going to watch this soon. Yeah.
Yeah. I've had Who's That Knocking at My Door and Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore on my HBO Max playlist for a while, like, and I just got to do it. I went to watch The King of Comedy.
I watched it
like a year or so ago. You know, it doesn't necessarily, it doesn't bring that same thunder that some of my favorites do. I think it doesn't have that really forward momentum that all the ones that I talked about, you know, Casino, The Departed, Wolf of Wall Street, Goodfellas, they just charge forward relentlessly. Once you start them, they're over. You know, and you're like, oh, I mean, I'm sure that others do, but.
What about Joker?
He didn't direct that.
No, but it's such a rip-off on
his movies. Yeah. Yeah.
I will say Wolf of Wall Street is probably like 4 or 5 on the list. It's very high up there.
It's incredibly enjoyable. Yeah.
It is, but it's just Goodfellas again.
Yeah, it's modern. It's like a modern, I don't know. Like, it feels like this guy shouldn't be able to do a movie like this.
Yeah.
And have it feel, you know, like when a great rock band releases a great rock album years after.
No, it's Green Day, American Idiot.
Yeah.
Very good.
I will say, if you're in the Los Angeles area and you can get tickets to the Academy Museum, which it's hard to get because it's just open and they're limiting entry, there's a whole section on the second floor about the people behind the scenes, like the artisans who do different aspects, like cinematographers or costume designers. And one of them is about editing, and it's all about Thelma. It's got all things, you know, it's got great photos and a recreation of her setup.
She's fascinating. Cool. Oh my God. I'm so glad I went. I saw Silence at the Museum of the Moving Image in Queens. They screened the film, and then Marty and Thelma did a talk afterwards, and just to watch the two of them hang out was just delightful. I'm so glad I went to that.
So there you go. Thanks, John V, for writing to contact@ifanboy.com with his Media Splode question. If you want to write in and have a question discussed in the show, please do so to contact@ifanboy.com and put Media Splode in the title so we just know which show it's meant for. Because sometimes it's hard to tell.
I just feel really, really relieved that Gabriel Hardman is never going to listen to what we do.
Oh, for sure. Never.
I'm so relieved.
All right, so there you go. That's this month's episode. Again, the patrons at patreon.com/ifanboy, they're the ones that unlocked this show, the Media Splode show, as well as the Booksplodes and Talksplodes that we do. Is there another one? That's it, right? The Hangouts.
Booksplode, Talksplode, Media Splode, Hangouts.
Those are all the shows. If we get to the next level, we'll unlock not a show, but we'll start covering TV shows again. We used to cover comic book TV shows. We stopped doing that. We will start covering them again in special edition format. So that's the next stretch goal at patreon.com/ifanboy. And we'll be back next month to discuss more things in non-comics media. This was fun. I enjoyed this.
I loved it. It was a great
discussion.
Fun. So good.
So until next time, I'm Connor.
I'm Ron.
I'm Josh. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means, and I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert-extrovert thing, and some people, you know, like, they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away, and, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened, but it can be tough to deal with. And also one of the things is like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.